I'm Thorne Dreyer, and you're driving in the left lane with Rag Radio. Tracy Schultz is here with me. Tracy's my engineer. Tracy, are you driving in the left lane with us?
Sure.
You're riding shotgun,
yeah,
as it were, since we're not really into guns. We'll have to figure out another way to communicate that. Rag Radio is a syndicated radio show that's produced in the studios of KOOP 91.7 FM in Austin, a cooperatively run, all-volunteer community radio station. We rebroadcast on several other stations, and our podcasts are put up all over the place. If you want to find us, if you want to find out where you can listen to us, and if you want to see links to all of our podcasts, go to the Rag Blog. That's theragblog, theragblog.com/ragradio. theragblog.com/ragradio. If you need to get in touch with us, it's ragradio@koop.org. All right. That's all the cool stuff. We said hi to Tracy. Tracy's my engineer and collaborator and partner in crime here. Nice weather out there, Tracy. Well,
it's holding.
It's holding. It's been a storm.
It's trying to rain.
It's trying to storm. But it's for those of you, and this includes Carl, who's in Pennsylvania, where I would imagine that it's kind of cool. Carl, is it cool?
It's actually, it's kind of nice. It's a little bit cool today, but it's been beautiful. We've had these 70-degree warm fall days with glorious color. Goes down to about 40 at night. Just about perfect.
Wow.
But
okay.
I think we're headed for lower temperatures.
Okay, well, because it's going down to about 60 at night here. So last night we went to a big art event, and it was in a warehouse, and it was just steamy hot. So we lag behind you guys a little bit, and we never quite get where you do. So, okay. Carl Davidson is a noted leftist thinker and political organizer. He will put on his noted thinking cap and help us make some sense out of the political madness that surrounds us. And there's sure a whole lot of political madness right now. Carl is co-chair of the committee.
Philosophical help 5 cents poster.
Okay. Carl is co-chair of the Committees of Correspondence for Democracy and Socialism and a national board member of Solidarity Economy Network. Was the founder of the online University of the Left and is a local Beaver County, Pennsylvania member of the Steelworkers Associates. Carl works with the Progressive Democrats of America and was a founder of Progressives for Obama. Carl is the author of several books, is a contributor to the Rag Blog, and also blogs at Keep On Keeping On. In the 1960s, Davidson was a national leader of SDS and was a writer and editor for The Guardian Newsweekly. This is Carl Davidson's fifth visit to Rag Radio. And so, like I think Alan Campbell said at the opening there, it puts you in the five timers club. I don't know what he said.
That was great.
But I'm sure that
for the voice of all the unloved beatniks of Texas.
Oh, we beatniks are well loved. Well, it depends. So I should also mention that Carl and I have been friends and colleagues since, I think, before they actually started recording history.
1966, yeah. Nothing happened before then.
No, exactly. That's when we started the Rag in Austin, too. So, you know, we were both involved in SDS together and whatever. Okay, I want to stop. And, I mean, I really am serious about, you're one of my touchstones, Carl. And I'm serious about wanting you to help us make sense of what's going on. And there's a whole lot of stuff. Your CCDS newsletter came out this morning, and it's full of stuff. Rough results, turmoil in the 2015 elections, right-wing Kentucky, split in GOP, socialism in Seattle. There's some ups. Bernie versus the Third Way were some of the articles that you reprinted in that. I've got stuff out of the top of the news here that there's just all kinds of amazing stuff that's going on, and especially as a result of the midterm elections. And I want to talk about all of that, and I want to talk about, you know, why we shouldn't be really depressed right now. You're real good at sort of responding to that because you of all of us, I think, are the best at having a long view.
So. Well, maybe you should be depressed right now.
Okay, all right.
But the point with the emphasis on right now, because everything changes.
Yeah, it does.
I sent around that little quote from Gromsky about the nature of the current crisis is that the old order is dying and the new ones can't be born yet. So it allows for a great variety of morbid symptoms.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I actually have that printed out and in front of me.
So, good.
Okay, good news today. Obama nixes Keystone Pipeline.
Right.
Bill McKibben says, we just made history together 4 years to the day after we surrounded the White House. President Obama has rejected the presidential permit for the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline. He says, the president's decision sets the standard for what climate action looks like, standing up to the fossil fuel industry and keeping fossil fuels in the ground.
One small step at a time.
Yeah, that's right. One small step. And so the first thing...
The election outcomes were a mess.
Oh, Kentucky was astounding. Things happened all over the country. I want to start right now, since it's in our neck of the woods, and since I think it maybe tells the story as well as anything out there, and I want to talk about the referendum in Houston,
right,
where the equal rights. I mean, more than 200 municipalities in this country have on their books civil rights protection for gays, lesbians, and transgender folks. Houston was one of those. Houston had for almost a year had this kind of this protection, but the right wing, a very highly organized Tea Party and fundamental religious group, first took contested that ordinance, took it to the Texas Supreme Court. The Supreme Court mandated that there be a referendum, a popular referendum. Houston happens to be, in fact, a pretty progressive, diverse, tolerant city, always has had that reputation, and has always had a very large, active gay community. And Anise Parker, the mayor, was the first openly gay mayor of a major U.S. city. So one would have thought this would have passed easily. Well, it was defeated in a landslide because of an incredible scare campaign that mostly involved fear of transsexuals going into bathrooms or of men pretending they were transsexuals going in and assaulting women in restrooms. That was made into this incredible issue, and it failed by a wide, wide margin. And I want to play a clip. Tracy, have you got that up? This is Anise Parker, mayor of Houston.
I've been an activist for more than 40 years. I have stood here in Houston four times when people were given the opportunity to vote on my rights. No one's rights should be subject to a popular vote. It is insulting, it is demeaning, and it is just wrong. And this was a campaign of fear-mongering and deliberate lies. This isn't misinformation. This is a calculated campaign of lies designed to demonize a little understood minority and to use that to take down an ordinance that 200 other cities across America and 17 states have successfully passed and operated under. They just kept spewing an ugly wad of lies from our TV screens and from pulpits. This was a calculated campaign by a very small but determined group of right-wing ideologues and the religionist right. And they know only how to destroy. not how to build up.
I think, Carl, the reason I thought that this issue was very interesting as a sort of point of reference is that it's part of the whole story, it seems to me, of what's happening in our politics is the ascendance of the power of untruth, of anti-science, of anti-fact, of email memes, of internet memes, of all of this kind of... it makes it look like we have a pretty ignorant or at least easily fooled public in this country. What do you think is happening?
Well, what happened in Houston is the canary in the coal mine. What is behind it has been something that's been developing for a long time, which is the rise of right-wing populism. And combined with that, a proto-fascist core that's based on a kind of politics of irrationalism. And that's a long-term trend that's been rising for some time. I remember back still when I was still in Chicago doing a slideshow and a long paper on it. We called it The Rise of Theocratic Fascism. Was the name we gave to it. And it's a growing danger, and that it would eventually split the Republican Party. And so, it's getting to that point now. You can see some of the really bizarre implications of it with, just some of the latest stuff around Ben Carson and his theories about the pyramids and all of that kind of stuff. It doesn't seem to be hurting him very much. I will say one thing about the ballot in Houston. It brings to mind to me an important thing we have to keep in mind when it comes to politics. Politics fall into two bags. Politics is self-expression, which usually serves to unite a militant minority. And politics is strategy, which is where you can unite the many to defeat the few, when you can unite a huge progressive majority. And it seems to me that this resolution fell through the cracks on that. Many of the other states, it's true, had passed this resolution, but all of them, a great many of them, had deleted the bathroom provision. They let everything else, there was quite a comprehensive resolution on all sorts of features, but they had deleted the bathroom sector. That doesn't mean that it was wrong, transsexual females should be able to use female bathrooms. It doesn't mean that it's wrong rationally. But in terms of the ability to, of the right wing to create a demon where there is none and to drive it home and to create a huge wedge issue, it was like an open invitation. Somebody should have thought to divide the question precisely because, something like this would happen. A lot of the progress we've made on gay and lesbian questions is because there's been a campaign for the last 10 years that gay people are as normal as anyone else. That hasn't reached to the trans, the consciousness around that has not reached around the question of transsexuals. Most people really have very little understanding of the nature of gender and the fact that there's two sexes, but there are multiple genders, and gender is a very fluid concept. And even though it only affects a small minority, 1%, 2% of the population, it's still a question of consistent democracy to take the right stand on it. But at the same time, you have to calculate these things politically when you're going into an election where you have to unite a majority.
Okay. The thing, by the way, about 25% of the turnout was about 25% in Houston. And we're talking a whole lot. I mean, this is a midterm election.
Right.
Everybody's midterm talking about
elections are always slower.
Yeah. That's Democrats don't come out.
Right. People don't come out.
And young people don't come out. But
average voter is 57-year-old suburban blue collar housewife in Dayton, Ohio.
Carl, that's a youngster. we can't see things through our lens. Huh? I'm just sort of starting to think, how long can we use that as an explanation? I mean, it's true, but something has to change. You know, we talk about, well, you know, gerrymandering, money in politics. There's all of these factors that are causing the ascendancy of the far right, right, and the religious right, because I think to a great extent what we're talking about is the religious right, and the mixing of politics with religion. But boy, you know, I mean, I just wonder, you know, I mean, how come this keeps getting, you know, we think like Trump, Donald Trump and Ben Carson, we thought Donald Trump was just a flash in the pan, and the staying power that he's shown has, I think, boggled a lot of minds. Maybe we have to start looking at things in a different way.
Well, one thing we have to do is we have to start looking at the big picture. That's what I meant by politics as strategy as opposed to politics as self-expression. We have to look at all the different arenas. And one of the most important ones is the arena of state government, which the left and progressive parts of our society tend to ignore. But it hasn't been ignored by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which funded in the millions of dollars by the Koch brothers and others. And they've successfully been funding and taking over state legislatures. There's what they call, in state governments, called a trifecta. That's where you have the governor and both houses of the state legislature controlled by one party. And right now there are 24 of them that are controlled. The GOP has 24 trifectas. The Democrats only have 5, California, Oregon, Vermont, Rhode Island, and I think Connecticut. And all the 24 GOP trifectas are in the states of the old Confederacy and then in the West. So you can see what's happening in terms of, and the reason why state government is so important is that they are thinking strategically, because it's state government that draws the congressional district lines. So if you can dominate state government, especially the state courts, you get to decide how to draw the district lines, which means you get to determine how many you get a way to turn the Democrats and or any other minority or any other party into a minority party, and you can turn the Republicans into a majority party. And that was very crucial for us here in Pennsylvania, and we just had this election where Labor went all out to elect Democratic judges, and we won on it because it was precisely upcoming redistricting, and we did not get caught with our pants down on that one. We managed to win. We did a clean sweep of some progressive Democratic judges. A lot of people don't even vote for the judges, but the labor movement here and others, black community and others, we went out of our way to help educate people about the importance of electing a slate of Democratic judges. And so that was a high point here in Pennsylvania. We were able to do that. But there's a counter trend on the upside, and this has to do with demographics. If you look at the major cities in the country, I would say probably in 5 years of the 100 largest cities in the country, and they will be a majority minorities. In other words, white voters will be a minority in the cities, in the largest cities in the country within 5 more years. So already it's the case in 43% of the country's largest cities. And what this has meant is that in running against the trend in state government, many cities are electing relatively progressive mayors, like Ross Baraka in Newark, de Blasio in New York, the new guy whose name escapes me, who just got elected in Philadelphia, a number of other places, and even in places like Chicago, which Chuy Garcia lost his bid. He still made a decent show of it. But there's also a progressive caucus in the city council. And New York has a sizable progressive caucus. And then, you know, as you mentioned in my CCDS Links newsletter, we featured Kashama Sawant in Seattle. Not only did she win, she had 3 Democrats that she managed to split off who were progressive Democrats who won with her, and so it gives her a block of 4. And she has very astutely managed to change the whole dynamic of the city politics of Seattle they're just, you know, winning that seat. Socialist Alternative is sort of very, very smart politics that a lot of the left can learn from, and how they and how they've won that race. Of course, they have somewhat unique circumstances.
Okay, Carl, we need to take a break. And just we've already gone through a third of the show. Can you believe that? it's just time flies when you're having fun. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Carl Davidson, and we'll be right back. All right, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio, and we're back with Carl Davidson, political organizer and left thinker, I like to say, because there are not that many people out there who do the kind of thinking that I think analysis of the scene as well as Carl does. Carl's also an old friend. Carl Davidson, I don't know if you were through with what you were saying about, and maybe you should continue about the positive stuff, because then I want to come back with a question about the right wing again. So,
well, I just add one final point. You know, I don't operate on a two-party system model. I don't think the two-party system model has much explanatory power for American politics today. I think we really have six parties operating in the country right now. And if you use that model, you can a lot of things get a lot clearer. You know, it's like when lightning strikes at night, all of a sudden you can see everything. So I use the six-party system model. You got two parties in under the Republican tent, the Tea Party and your multinational Republicans. Under the Democratic tent, you've got blue dogs like Jim Webb. They're a shrinking bunch. You've got the Third Way, Bill Daley, Rahm Emanuel, Goldman Sachs party. You've got the old New Dealers, which is Campaign for America's Future and AFL-CIO. And then over on the left, you've got the Congressional Progressive Caucus, which is 80 votes, which is a group founded by Bernie Sanders, which is where rainbow politics are done and where you actually find social Democrats. And so that grouping is the equivalent in the U.S. of what would be, say, Die Linke in Germany or Syriza in Greece or something like that. So if you use that model, you can begin to see the strengths and weaknesses that exist and the openings that exist for us, even though the Republican Party is splitting. The growth of the right now also means the Republican Party is splitting. And at the same time, our end of it, we have our huge insurgency going on right now around the Congressional Progressive Caucus Party, so to speak, around the candidacy of Bernie Sanders. So it gives you a clearer picture. And what you're seeing is that there's an insurgency on both ends, and the center is weakening. The center will not hold. That's a little quote from William Butler Yeats that I sent you.
Yes.
Makes sense.
I have that printed out here, too. Not that I was going to read them, but it just they just seem to sort of sum it all up in so many ways. So, one thing that I wonder, and we can go into that more because I think that's very interesting, and I'm especially interested in what's happening with the Republican Party because it seems like all of the energy is on the right. There's a lot of energy on the left right now with Bernie Sanders, but over the larger picture, and throughout the country, it seems like now what happened in Houston, what happened in Kentucky aren't necessarily unique. Obviously, you're looking at small turnout, you're looking at midterm elections, but it seems like unless we have an Obama, you know, or a Sanders to sort of generate all of this energy, it seems like the right has a real advantage, partly because they don't care about fact. They don't care about science. They know how to use, I think they know how to use the new media very well, and they're just, and they're treacherous in their consciousness. And I don't think the left is willing to play those kind of games, and thus has a real problem right now with real politic.
I think there's one thing you left out. They know how to organize.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
The right wing has been, they started this back with the new right, back with the beginning of the Reagan campaign. They've been organizing. They work at the very grassroots, using evangelical churches as their base communities, and then going on from there. And they've been building an organizing model of participatory politics for at least the last 30, 40 years. We used to do that. We used to be organizers, but somewhere along the line we got changed. We changed into activists. We got into activistism. We became activists rather than organizers. When you and I were young, our heroes were all organizers.
Right.
We all aimed to be organizers.
Right.
Organizers build organizations.
Activists go out and do things for themselves.
Activists take part in movements. Yeah. They're like surfers, you know, they ride the waves. The organizers are the ones who build the boats can fill the harbors and cross the
sea. I think I'm getting seasick here, but go ahead.
I'm mixing my metaphors.
Oh, I love it.
You get the idea.
Yeah, I do.
And the right wing has been very good at building organization, and we have not been so good at building organization. There's some exceptions. I think Progressive Democrats of America is one example, and they were the ones who actually convinced Bernie to run. He didn't want to run, but we finally got, I think, 50,000 signatures on petitions to convince him to do it and to run in the Democratic primary. So he had something of an organizational base there to start with. It didn't just come out of nowhere. But look at it this way. You know, you've got... Here you are in Austin. I talked about the 100 biggest cities in the country. In Texas, you've got 12 of them. 12 of the 100 largest cities in the country are in Texas. You've got your voice, your organizing political, cultural voice in Austin. You've got the political organization around it. But what about the other 11 cities? You've got to get them organized. You've got to get PDA chapters out there. Or they don't have to be PDA. They can be the functional equivalent thereof. They can be political organizations that can be based on rainbow politics, that can be part of the, see itself represented in Congress by the Congressional Progressive Caucus. And do you have a Progressive Caucus on the Austin City Council or the other 12 major city councils of the major cities in Texas?
Well, there's in Austin, there's not a Progressive Caucus, but there's basically a Progressive City Council.
Good.
So...
Good.
You know.
So now you got the other 11 major cities.
Although we have to look at progressive. They're theoretically progressive. They're certainly progressive on environmental issues. But Austin is overcome by the mighty dollar right now and the power of real estate growth.
You have to also have to build it on the ground. It's not just you have to have organizations that those people are accountable to.
Certainly.
That's the lesson of Kashama Sawant in Seattle. See, before her first run, she ran an at-large seat, and she just ran off. She won off her own charisma and some organizing skill. But then they changed it up on her, and she had to actually represent a ward. So she had to build a real ward organization with hundreds of organizers going door to door and building a ward organization among working-class voters and getting unions behind her and everything. And she did that. And so that's why, even with just one socialist on city council, just changed the whole dynamic of politics in the city of Seattle. So those are the kinds of things that we have to do. The openings are there for us to do it, and the demographics are there for us on the urban level, and then we can use those urban strongholds as our strong point to counter the right wing, which sort of bases itself on the inherent bias in the U.S. political structure, which favors rural and suburban areas. So we have to counter that by building our, we have to surround the countryside with the cities.
Well, you know, it's interesting, too, because Texas, you know, I mean, Texas, everybody hates Texas and I and thinks that Texas is just the absolute backwater of the world. And,
I love Texas.
Certainly those.
I think it's great that the state capitol is made exactly like the U.S. Congress, except one foot higher.
Yeah, we do everything a little better. But, you know, the fact is that Texas is kind of like most other places. Texas is urban versus rural. Texas is, I mean, it's the state capitol is a clown college, and the people and the Republicans have managed to create a situation of power that's continuing, and some real idiots get elected to major positions in Texas. But the fact of the state, you know, demographically, Texas should be a progressive state, but you can't get people out to vote. And that's
right.
That has to be obviously the critical thing to look at, and that involves organizing.
That's exactly right. That's where the question of organization comes in. And see, the right wing has a decades head start on this, but I think we're better at it than them if we put our minds to it. Besides, we have a just cause, which makes it easier. We're actually organizing people to fight for their interests rather than against their interests.
Yeah, but you know,
people don't always see it that way.
I know.
They have conflicted consciousness, you know.
Don't they though? There was one of the I'm gonna find it here. One of the articles I went through the news today, and oh boy, and pulled out a bunch of articles and put some quotes together from them and stuff, which I'm not going to bore everybody with reading. But one of the things, LA Times, Bernie Sanders' momentum stalls in an unlikely place, union halls. I mean, we're talking about whether people are working for their interests or not.
Right. I know this one up close and personal. Right here in Beaver County, for instance, we've got all of the most dynamic activist organizers from all the different locals of all different major unions are gung-ho for Bernie. But the unions themselves, the way they look at it, they only want to put their money on the winner, and they assume that Hillary's going to be the winner, and so they're going to put their money there. So you've got a built-in clash between the organizers at the base and the leadership at the top in terms of how they're going to hedge their bets. In other words, the organizers at the base are members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus Party, whereas the people at the top of the union are members of the AFL-CIO Campaign for America's Future Party. The two of them together, to have a progressive majority, you need both of them to form an alliance. But at the same time, you know, that's a problem, and it's going to be one, and it's a. Until you can see it in those terms and begin, then once you see it in those terms, then you can begin to do something about it.
While we're talking about the Bernie Sanders campaign, it's, you know, I don't know. I don't work under the, I mean, I love Bernie Sanders and I'm working for him in every way I can, but I'm not working under the assumption that he's going to be the Democratic nominee. And I think that he's doing two things, and there are two things we have to look at. One is changing the dialogue. He and
right.
Elizabeth Warren have done more, I think, than anybody on the national scene to change, to along with the Occupy movement, to make us understand about Wall Street, to make us understand about income inequality. You know, I mean, they've coined, I mean, the billionaire class and the 1%. It's just so true. It's so accurate. And I think it's changed the dialogue. It's opened people up to the concept of socialism very dramatically.
Right.
Suddenly it's not an evil word. And it actually wasn't, it was already not an evil word with people under 35, I think.
Right.
But the other thing is that I think that there's an incredible, I want to see that Bernie Sanders organization do what I don't think Barack Obama did, which is to take all of that and turn it into something lasting.
But here's the point, Thorne. That's not his job.
No.
That's,
I understand.
That's your and my job.
Okay.
To build that organization. Bernie has got his hands full just running the damn campaign. You know, going from state to state, concentrating his efforts, giving these speeches day in and day out. It's up, but it's up to us at the base to build the new PDA chapters. You're right, Bernie is the long shot candidate, and he's still running to win, and long shots do come in at times, but at the same time, we understand he's the long shot candidate. But this is not a horse race. This is an organizing opportunity. That's the way we have to view the election.
Exactly.
And if we don't come out of this election without doubling or tripling the number of PDA chapters in the country, then shame on us. And that's on us. That's not on Bernie. He's made it possible for us to do that, but we're the ones who actually have to do it.
You're certainly right, but I think the organizational structure, I mean, it's very important that those doing the organizing, that those doing the petitions to get him on the ballot, those doing all of that kind of grassroots work are also putting together the email list, putting together the lasting contacts, putting together the rudiments of organization that, you know, I mean, it's important that they think about it in terms of more than just an election.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, in terms of getting the list and things like that, that won't be a problem. But the real question is, it's still, if you want a PDA chapter in your congressional district, you have to organize it. You, Thorne Dreyer. You and a dozen of your friends have to be the ones pulled together.
Tracy?
You and Bernie Sanders campaign can give you a bunch of emails, but when all is said and done, it's you guys. That's the kind of grassroots politics. You know, to put it in an old framework, think of it as SNCC versus Martin Luther King.
Right.
SNCC versus SCLC. King used to come around and give all these great speeches and have big marches and mobilization, and then he would leave.
For those who don't know, SNCC was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. That was
the grassroots organization.
The grassroots organization.
Building the local committees, building the local freedom labor unions, building the co-ops, and so on, in every little county in Mississippi. And so that's the point I'm making. We have to be SNCC, not SCLC.
Right, right. Okay. I'm making a little note of that right now. So, no, but your point is certainly well taken there. All right, Will, it's another breaking point. So we'll take advantage of the breaking point to take a break. Carl Davidson is my guest. We're talking, we're trying to make a little sense of what's going on, and I'm not sure how much sense we've made so far, but we'll keep trying. We'll be right back in just a minute. Tracy? Okay, so we read the news today, and we're talking about it, and it's kind of scary, Tracy, don't you think?
Yeah, but I guess that's part of the discussion. It's like, where do we go from here?
Right. Yeah. What is to be done? Carl Davidson is our guest. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio. Carl is We're trying to talk about, we're trying to make some sense out of the political madness. Carl is co-chair of the Committees of Correspondence for Democracy and Socialism, a national board member of Solidarity Economy Network. I can't even talk. And has been involved with the Progressive Democrats of America, PDA, which we've been talking about. Looking over the news stories, Ben Carson, who is, I think, an astounding phenomenon, and in some ways is more interesting than Donald Trump, especially when we talk about the role of the religious right. Today, two different things. It's his resume. Today, the story is Ben Carson's resume. According to Politico, Carson's campaign says he was never offered a West Point scholarship. Republican presidential candidate Ben Carson's campaign on Friday acknowledged he actually never applied nor was accepted to the U.S. Military Academy, a tale he included in his autobiography. And then Ben Carson, this is from the Washington Post, Ben Carson's troubled effort to prove that he was, in fact, a juvenile delinquent. Part of the narrative that he's put out about himself is that he got into these fights. He almost tried to kill somebody with a knife and whatever. And nobody can find any evidence of that having been the case. But will that even hurt him? You know, I mean, we just wonder how much, you know, there's so many things that we thought would disqualify these folks that seem to actually just enhance their position.
Well, I think the thing you have to do about understand is
I'm not sure what the question was there. But.
Well, I think it's trying to make sense of what that doesn't. It seems very irrational. A kind of politics of irrationalism, and it is true that it's a politics of irrationalism. And Ben Carson's story, or his narrative, I should say, is just one part of it. And he has a strong point. He told CNN, you know, that they can't prove a negative, which is true. I mean, he's spun this story about himself, and it has a vital component in it. If he's going to win over the religious right, it's not enough that he was Horatio Alger. He has to have been a sinner,
right?
And then he can be Horatio Alger because he has been redeemed, and he's repented his sin. And without that part, so that's why he has to be a juvenile delinquent. He just can't be a poor boy who's made well, who worked hard and made well. He has to be a sinner who's repented, and then done well by the grace of God. That's what is vital to his story and his rise and the irrationalism of that kind of politics. Here's the deal. I think we need to understand right-wing populism. At the core of it is what's called producerism. It divides the world into two, producers and parasites. Producers are white guys moving heavy stuff around in factories, small businessmen running gas stations or little corner grocery stores, the guys who run your local savings and loan bank. Those are all producers. Parasites, there's two kinds of parasites. There's parasites way at the top, you know, your huge banksters, and above them, the Jews. And then there's parasites below, you know, the unemployed, the immigrants, the illegals, people of color, people who are not heterosexual. So it's producers versus parasites. And the trick of the people who manipulate right-wing populism is to get you to go after the parasites below and don't pay too much attention to the ones above. That's sort of the difference between left-wing and right-wing populism, whether you're aiming at the parasites below or the parasites above. So that's the way it works. And that's sort of the when you're talking to people at the Tea Party, if you understand that about their thinking, and it's based on a great deal of insecurity, their insecurity as producers, they've maybe gotten a little bit of a pension, they've got something of Social Security, but they are very precarious and very insecure, and that's why they cling to it. They don't think the pie is going to get any bigger, and they don't want anybody else dividing the pie up into smaller slices. And so that's sort of, you know, the heart and soul of it. So you have a lot of angles there you've got to do to order to, you know, to divide up amongst them and to try to break them up. But in order to do that, we have to unite the progressive forces over on the other side first, which has to do mainly with rainbow politics merging with a kind of class struggle politics. And youth-oriented politics as well, because the youth are the most dynamic and energetic force of any any force for change, as you and I well know from the 1960s. And, you know, the stuff around Bernie is really interesting because it's really not new. It's really, it started with Occupy. And you had Occupy, and then you had Black Lives Matter in a way, which is a more multinational Occupy 2.0. And now you had the insurgency around Bernie, which is also kind of Occupy 3.0. I went to some of these younger meetings in Pittsburgh of some of these younger kids, and they all wanted to speak bitterness. You know, they were all fresh out of college, burdened with huge debt. They couldn't find a job. They could only get, you know, minimum wage jobs. This one woman I knew was there talking. She was almost in tears because she and her boyfriend couldn't form a family. They were both still living at their parents' house. They wanted to get married and start a family. They just didn't have the means to do it. So, in a way, it's something we used to talk about in the 60s, or the one which was the rise of the new working class. And that's, in a sense, that's what all these young people are. It's finally, it's taken them quite a few number of years, but it's come to fruition. So that's another component of the rainbow politics that has to be brought into it, this youth insurgency. And I think there we have the progressive forces that we can assemble a progressive majority. Politics has two things. We need two things. We need a militant minority. We need the organizations of a militant minority. That's why I'm a member of CCDS and other groups like that. But we also need a militant minority of a progressive majority. So that's why I'm a member of like a group like PDA, which is, you know, because of its positions it takes, all the positions it takes are those that are held by a majority of the electorate. They might not act on them, but there's no barrier to them. Everybody's for raising the minimum wage. Everybody's for, you know, getting a break on going to college and not being burdened by huge student debt. Everybody wants windmills and not weapons. So those are the dynamics that we have out there to work with, and it's going to be tough. It's going to be, you know, there's serious battles that have to be waged. These guys on the other side mean business. They really want to repeal the New Deal. They even want to repeal anything that Teddy Roosevelt ever did around the Progressive Era. They are very serious about this kind of stuff. And so we have to really get back into it, being organizers again, and dig in and start taking them on.
When you say, and certainly I think we maybe need to do another whole show, not about all of this, but about what the real stuff, what is going on in organizing, and what's going on with workers' cooperatives, you know, how we can move forward. But I think that's a whole other show. Although it's obviously a part of what we're talking about, but I wanted to mention that when I was looking at the news stories, I pulled something out that I put down, and I just thought, ah, this is funny. Time magazine: live tapeworm still wiggling when it's pulled out of man's brain. But on the other hand, it actually seems kind of relevant. When you talked about positions held by the majority, the irony of the fact that, you know, that most people in this country, according to polling, tend to have rather progressive positions on most of the issues, especially the social issues. And yet the conversation is not defined by them. I mean, once it comes down to elections, that isn't what we see. And one of the things that I see the right wing doing is it's like a logical paradox, you know, where you can't argue with it. When you talked about the Jews at the top, for instance, although that's not something that's spoken of necessarily, but the conspiracy theory approach to analyzing reality it's all the liberal media. You know, if you fact check something and you say here, you know, well, they say, well, the fact checking is a liberal conspiracy. It's that stuff that scares me. And the other thing that scares me when we talk about Ben Carson or Donald Trump, who really scares me is Ted Cruz.
No, I agree. I think he's of all of them, I would say he's the most dangerous. Because of not only what he represents, but his father, too. His father's a Christian Reconstructionist. This is the most fascistic of the theocrats,
right?
Christian theocrats. But no, the thing is that Gromsky, who's one of my political people I look to for political insight, talks about common sense as being what we're up against, and the politics of common sense. And common sense is what's given to us, the kinds of constructs that are, you know, the things about right-wing populism, the producerism, the producers versus the parasites, all of this stuff that is held by a lot of people who act politically against their own best interests are trapped in the politics of common sense. And what Gromsky argues is that what our job as permanent persuaders or as revolutionary educators is that our job is to tease good sense out of common sense. Good sense is the sense that enables people to understand who they really are and what their interests really are. And to do that, you often have to peel away a lot of common sense explanations, because every single one of us has a conflicted consciousness. You know, some people use the term false consciousness. I always argue against it. I think it's kind of elitist, because it assumes, number one, that there's a true consciousness and that we're the ones who have a true consciousness. I don't think that's the case. I think we all have a conflicted consciousness that's made up of contending and contradictory identities, interests, and sets of values. And whenever you talk to anybody, no matter where they are in the political spectrum, your job as an organizer is to find the progressive elements of their consciousness that you can seize on that and then win over other aspects of it to isolate the most backward aspects of it, to tease the good sense out of the common sense. And the way you do it is you get people to do something together, even if it's just to go to a meeting. Like, we're having a meeting here on trying to keep our water pure. So I'll get a few people to go to this meeting who may be right-wing populists to go to the meeting with me. But then once we go to the meeting, I get them to reflect on it. And that's the pedagogy of the oppressed. That's what Pablo Freire talks about. Take an action and then reflect on it. That's the way people really learn. That's the way you break with the politics of irrationalism.
Is that how you defeat that wriggling worm that we're trying to pull out of the brain?
It's not easy, and as we know, that worm can be quite long,
and can wriggle for quite a while.
Right, exactly. It's a complex task, but you know, that's what we're up against.
Okay, one more just topical thing, and because it's your wisdom in general, you know, is sort of gives us flight, I think. But the question about the governor of Kentucky and the fact that his rising out of the ashes, and the special issue of what that's going to do. This is an interesting story that says Kentucky's Republican governor elect Matt Bevin won this week, promising to scrap the state's Connect insurance exchange created under President Barack Obama. But yet Connect, which Bevin has called part of a financially ill-advised program, in 2 years has enrolled 521,000 people in Medicaid or federally subsidized private plans. How is he going to do that, and what's going to happen when he comes up against that?
Well, see, that's the problem with the politics of irrationalism.
Right.
Reality is rational.
We have 1 minute,
by
the way.
You come up against it. So he's going to be up against it. He's going to have to crapper get off the crapper.
I remember that expression. But is he going to be able to do it? I mean, what happens with that? How can people repeal Obamacare, I guess,
in that case, how can he get rid of Medicaid?
In the larger sense, yes.
In Kentucky.
Yeah.
Especially when it's all, mostly white folks and poor white coal miners that are benefiting from it.
Okay, we're almost out of time. Give us a hopeful conclusion here.
Right-wing populism is highly unstable and full of contradictions, as we just noted by talking about Kentucky. And because of that, if we put our minds to it, we can take it down.
Do you think that when they all take power, that they're just going to blow it? Because, is that maybe the answer? Let them have it, and then...
No. That's the worst. They have to be fought every step of the way. But at the same time, these solutions are rising because the things are getting exhausted. We're getting to a point where the center will not hold, and the second coming is arising.
Right.
By that means that the opening of revolutionary possibilities. But my question is that we have to be organized to take advantage of it.
Okay, thank you so much. Carl Davidson, thank you for being with us one more time on RAG Radio, and we won't let it be as long before the next time.
Anyway, I'll join the Sixer Club.
That's right.
Anytime you want.
It's even, you become more elite every time. So.
Right, there you go.
Okay. Coming up on November 20th, the O. Henry Museum's Michael Hoinsky and Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist and illustrator Ben Sargent on the publishing of O. Henry's Lost Manuscript, As Others See Us. A change of pace, but something really interesting. I think I'll really enjoy that show. All right. Thank you, Tracy Schultz. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio,